to passage in the House. This is a substantively bad decision that is political malpractice. It represents a betrayal. Politically, it's unclear what Republicans are thinking. President Biden entered this week reeling from a devastating rebuke of his presidency by voters in areas of the country thought to be reliably Democratic. He headed into the 2022 election year a wounded animal, and Republicans stood to make major gains. Now they tossed him a life raft and allowed him to put bipartisan gloss on his radical agenda. Every Republican who voted for this monstrosity, who is not already retiring, should be primaried and defeated by candidates who will actually resist the left-wing agenda. Those who are retiring should be shamed for the rest of their lives. It also is not too soon to be asking whether Representative Kevin McCarthy should be ousted from leadership for his inability to keep his caucus together on such a crucial vote. And that last one is a key point here. The bill included lots of popular projects and in another era probably wouldn't have gotten significantly more GOP votes. But we live in this era in which delivering a political win for the other side, however popular the bill and however much your constituents might want it, is seen as apostasy. The demand in the GOP for such devotion to the party line and its election prospects is even greater than on the other side. Republicans are still likely to win the House in 2022 midterm elections, despite the doom and gloom on the GOP side, and even as it's likely the bill's passage will help Democrats electorally. That puts Kevin McCarthy in line to be House Speaker. But we've written before about the undersold potential debate over whether he would even be elevated to a post he's already failed to grab hold of once. Kevin McCarthy's leadership has been quite often uneven, and the demands in the GOP are sky-high for such posts. Scalise, too, would seem to be in line for some criticism given his status as the party's whip. The anger for now seems more focused on those 13 Republicans. It's possible Democrats would have been able to pass the bill without them. The GOP crossover votes allowed the progressives who had been holding out to vote no and stick to their principled stance. But the end result is that, objectively, this bill passed thanks to GOP votes. Whether Kevin McCarthy could have prevented the bill's passage is a valid question. He doesn't control the majority after all, but his party and its base aren't really big on that kind of nuance. And it's unlikely the anger over what transpired on Friday will subside quickly. The Republicans who voted for the infrastructure bill, the defectors were Don Bacon of Nebraska, Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, Andrew Garbarino of New York, Anthony Gonzalez of Ohio, John Katko of New York, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, Nicole Maniotakis of New York, David McKinley of West Virginia, Tom Reed of New York, Chris Smith of New Jersey, Fred Upton of Michigan, Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey, and Don Young of Alaska.
A song that has the fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence, to anchor in the harbor of its own. existence. I want to decipher the Oriental thoughts and secrets and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity.
The Eastern Wisdom and Iqbal Lahori. Part 1.
I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimates alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises, may they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with the companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 नवंबर 1877 को सुबह 5
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
इस घर की इब्तिदा की 6 फरवरी 1861
The house here was built by his grandfather Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February 1861, he bought 3 small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and 4 sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hisamuddin Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I have asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences, Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is a result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
1891 में उन्होंने यहाँ में He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade. And it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and composed his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world, a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA right here. In fact, spent both his BA and MA here in this dormitory, in this very dormitory.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through 2 periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I met much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, Max Neckrat, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elien Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his doctor of philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days, British colonialism, and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century, but as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I, in 1918, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab Parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured the wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say, a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of the last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succory, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abyss for them attainable.
Iqbal's message is addressed only to the youth. He calls them royal falcons. As held by Iqbal, the royal falcon has five characteristics. Iqbal wants the youth to catch hold of falcon's characteristics as much as possible. The five good attributes of the royal falcon, as seen by Iqbal, are flying high. So Iqbal wants the youth to fly high for sure. The second attribute is keen eyesight. The youth can fly high only if they have keen eyesight. Its third attribute is that it does not build a nest, nor does it follow richness. The fourth attribute, it loves solitude, as it is a source of creativity. The last attribute, as told by Iqbal of the royal falcon, is it does not eat the prey hunted by others. Iqbal wants the youth to show these five attributes.
Thank you. follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
U.S. leaders' credibility is sagging at home and abroad as speculation swells about a possible Trump return in 2024. We're prepared for you an article written by Daniel Williams, a former foreign correspondent for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and Miami Herald, and an ex-researcher for Human Rights Watch. The piece is titled Biden's Foreign Policy Undercut by Domestic Weakness. So far, no American ally has felt a need to react to the election debacles President Joe Biden suffered recently, notably in the state of Virginia, which his party controlled but then lost, and also in lesser votes elsewhere across the country. Usually, there is no reason for, say, a German leader to comment on a vote in a middle-sized American state. But in this case, cables sent out from foreign allies' embassies in Washington will likely need to grapple with this question. Is Biden already so wounded that in just over 3 years he'll be replaced in 2024 elections and have his foreign policy initiatives overturned by a purported nationalistic populist in the image of Donald Trump, or even by Donald Trump himself? His ratings in political surveys are as bad as Donald Trump's at their worst. Voters have begun to wonder if, with the spectacle of Biden's occasional incoherent babbling, he's up to the job of the presidency. Part of allied nations' worry centers on the growing habit of U.S. presidents to hang foreign initiatives on their own signature instead of gaining wider political consensus. In America's volatile political landscape, this trend throws the staying power of U.S. policy into doubt. If a president believes he can't get consent for a treaty from two-thirds of the U.S. Senate, as constitutionally required, he forges ahead anyway and calls it something else. For example, Anne-Marie Slaughter, a former diplomat who runs New America, a Washington think tank, wrote, "The Paris Climate Accord, signed with dozens of other countries in 2015, was not labeled a treaty, but an executive agreement, binding only President Barack Obama's administration." The same was true of Barack Obama's complex deal with Iran, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. He called it a non-binding agreement that committed the United States to lifting sanctions on Iran. The late hawkish Senator John McCain complained at the time, "They can call it a banana, but it's a treaty." The weakness of each maneuver was evident when Donald Trump took power after Barack Obama, because neither the Paris Climate Accord nor the Iran nuclear deal was ratified in the Senate. Donald Trump simply overturned each with the stroke of a pen. This year, Joe Biden has quickly reinstated the Paris Climate Accord and wants to return to the Iran nuclear accord. But what will happen after 2024? We'll be right back. William Howell, a University of Chicago political scientist, predicted America's whiplash foreign policy presents uncertainty among U.S. allies, adding, "Pervasive gridlock, polarization, and distrust that characterize our national politics will give foreign leaders some pause before entering into long-term, costly agreements with us." Max Bergman, a fellow of the Leftist Center for American Progress and specialist in relations with Europe, said, "I think there is a real sort of underlying concern that America's return may be temporary." He added, "Europeans are a little bit wary of following the lead of the United States." Joe Biden insisted his election last year represented a clear return to U.S. leadership in world affairs. At the G7 summit and NATO summit last summer, he claimed that America is back. Allies understood that he meant that the mercuric Donald Trump and his America First attitudes had been pushed off stage. They publicly welcomed Joe Biden with a hesitant satisfaction, but analysts said Western joy was tempered by an underlying fear that some version of Trump's nationalistic populism, an ideology with a two-century history in the United States, might in fact live on. Gerard Araud, a former French ambassador to the United States, commented, "After Biden, it may be Trump again." He added, "We Europeans, we have to learn to be grown up. We have to learn to defend or to handle our interests by ourselves." Virginia's election did not turn on foreign affairs, but nonetheless showed American populism is alive and well. The defeat of Virginia's state governor, deputy governor, and attorney general were largely built on dissatisfaction among parents with school bureaucrats, disdain for complaints about frameworks for teaching racial history. Nonetheless, by equating political control at home with an ability to lead the free world, Joe Biden set himself up for embarrassment. Since taking office, he claimed the United States must show the world democracy can work. On the eve of his trip to Europe recently for a G20 summit and COP26 climate conference, Joe Biden cajoled his own Democratic Party legislators in Congress to approve a $550 billion worth of programs to fight climate change. He warned, "The rest of the world wonders whether we can function." His chief congressional ally, House Leader Nancy Pelosi, said legislators must pass the spending measure so Biden wouldn't be embarrassed when he got off his plane in Europe. But the legislators failed to endorse the package, and Joe Biden left Washington empty-handed. U.S. allies abroad had already been flummoxed by a series of Biden foreign policy missteps that made them wonder whether about his competence. NATO partners criticized Joe Biden for the chaotic and incomplete evacuation of Americans and other foreigners and Afghan collaborators as Kabul fell to the Taliban. He enraged France, America's oldest ally, by quietly arranging a new anti-Chinese alliance with Britain and Australia, which denied Paris a $100 billion submarine deal with Canberra. The secretive partnership agreement also seemed a snub at continental Europe's importance as a strategic partner. The French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said, "This brutal, unilateral, and unpredictable decision reminds me a lot of what Donald Trump used to do. I'm angry and bitter. This isn't done between allies." In the name of controlling climate change, Joe Biden began to curb U.S. fossil fuel production, but in order to keep American fuel prices low, he begged United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia to produce more oil. Since January, tens of thousands of illegal immigrants have crossed the United States' southern border unhindered. Biden appointed Vice President Kamala Harris to solve the problem. she traveled to Central America for talks about the flow, returned to declare the trip was a success in terms of a pathway that is about progress, and didn't take up the issue again. The migrants keep coming, to the majority dismay of Americans. In the Washington Post, a conservative Biden critic traced the beginnings of the president's electoral problems in the United States to the botched Afghan withdrawal. The critic opined, after his Afghanistan debacle, the floor fell out from under the president. On the other side of the globe, it's unclear whether China worries about Biden's image problem at home. China is convinced that the United States is inexorably hostile, no matter who is president. U.S. military leaders have labeled China a pacing threat, Pentagon language meaning it is on the military rise. U.S. naval cruisers through the contested South China Sea, which China considers its own, and support for Taiwan's separate status from China, all convince Beijing the United States won't change course whoever might be elected in 2024. China has held numerous military maneuvers around the self-governing island and staged jet bomber flights over its airspace, both as practice for a possible invasion of Taiwan and as psychological intimidation, regardless of Joe Biden's floundering at home or abroad. To counter this, Biden hopes to renew dormant alliances in the Far East and add India to the mix. But potential partners will likely think twice about joining an anti-China coalition with a perpetually wavering and increasingly weak American administration.
Oh, hey, hello there. To be honest, I was thinking about what the director said today. It was a challenge. He asked me to name one thing in the studio that is not made of any mineral source, such as oil or metals. Believe me, nothing came to mind. You're right there. One of today's topics is mines and mineral products in Iran. Iranians are lucky to live in a land with really rich mines. They have access to most mineral rocks, actually. Iran is the world's 17th largest country. It covers 1% of all land mass on the planet. Iranian soil happens to be located on Earth's metallurgical belt. That is a belt rich in minerals, all of which the modern world has great need for. Copper, gold, iron, lead, and zinc are but small examples. Even so, there's been minimal investment in exploration in Iran, and so this country is not aware of its full potential. For example, Iran is estimated to possess 7% of the world's resources. But in 2015, of $9 billion worth of exploration, Iran's share was just $25 million. That's just 0.3%. Therefore, investment in this sector would be highly profitable to foreign companies. Iranians themselves haven't sat back idly either. They've invested extensively in the mine sector. For a close-up view of what Iranians have done in this regard, we set out for an industrial complex to watch their production process from A to Z. And to begin with, what could be better than copper? Copper has the best electrical conductivity of all metals except for silver. and the world of telecommunications is based upon a copper infrastructure. From your everyday clothes to the plate of your food, from the car you drive to the screen on which you are watching this program, everything you are, in one way or another, in contact within your everyday life has something to do with minerals. Mines have in fact shaped expansion of human civilization. Meanwhile, countries richer in mineral resources and more technologically developed to extract minerals from deposits are apt to see more progress. Hearing the name of Iran in economic communities would generally remind one of oil and gas. It is true that the country sits atop at least 10% of the world's proven crude oil and nearly 18% of gas reserves. However, there might be relatively very few who know that the same Iran is in possession of 7% of the mineral deposits worldwide as well. Copper is one of the most profitable minerals in Iran that is widely used in many countries. Given its preferred conductivity, copper is used in nearly all categories of electrical engines and wiring. It is also used for construction of ships and pipes to prevent calcium and lime buildup. Copper and its alloys are natural antimicrobial materials and are used in many medicinal preparations, among other uses. This is Ahmad Morad Alizadeh. He used to manage National Iranian Copper Industries Company. This company owns three big mines in two provinces of Kerman and East Azerbaijan. It is the third most profitable company in Iran's stock exchange market. After 1.5 hours' drive from central Kerman, we arrived in Sarcheshme, where these huge holes were once big mountains, having been dug out over time. One of Iran's biggest copper mines is located in Sarcheshme, 159 kilometers south of the southern city of Kerman. Sarcheshme is considered to hold the 15th biggest copper deposits worldwide. By itself, Kerman province is viewed as one of the richest regions in Iran for its mineral reserves. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the show so far and found it educational. Our tour of Sarcheshme city and its grand factory is not over yet, but I'd best give you this information right here, right now. You may not see Iran listed among the world's top 10 richest countries in copper, but Iran enjoys special privileges in this domain. First of all, Iranian copper is really highly concentrated. Secondly, Iran has mines that are either untouched or not yet expanded. Given copper is expensive in world markets and Iran offers attractive conditions to investors, Iranian mines would be the best investment option.
After exploration is done, they will blast the mine to start excavation. Workers will transfer the rich soil to the factory. Here, in these machines, the soil will be crushed until it is broken down to 80 micron grains. Then, using flotation method, waste is separated. These scary furnaces make copper anodes. Now pure copper is almost in the reach. Anodes are then moved to refineries, and using electrolysis method, they'll be transformed into cathode, which is 99.99% pure copper. Iran's revenues from the sale of copper have dwindled in recent years due to the weak demand from top copper consumer China, thanks to an economic slowdown in the country. Although Trump's biting sanctions are back on track, this company is planning to produce 540,000 tons of copper in the near future. The country is planning to lure foreign investors into the sector, however. Investment data shows that a sizable majority of investments offered by foreign financiers in Iran since January 2016 that Tehran's Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, was implemented, were aimed at capitalizing projects in the mining sector. Development of the sector would not only lead to faster economic growth in Iran, but would also tackle unemployment. In order to facilitate the arrival of foreign investors into the country and addressing their concerns, the Organization for Investment, Economic and Technical Assistance of Iran, an affiliate to the Ministry of Economy, has been established to play an instrumental role in this regard. For more information on the ins and outs of investing in Iran, check www.investiniran.ir.
Copper is but one of Iran's mineral industries. Another Iranian produce is iron, plenty of which is to be found on this land. Just one example is the iron mine of Golgohar City, where over 1,250,000,000 tons of iron ore lie dormant. This mine is in southern Iran and has a long way to go before exhaustion. Eastern Iran also has its riches. There lies the Sangon mine, with over 850,000,000 tons of iron ore waiting to be extracted. We'll visit these mines in future shows. Be you rich or poor, busy exploring new mines or new galaxies, you can do nothing without hydrocarbons, vitamins, and proteins. To provide food for 7 billion people is no easy task. Given such vast population, human life today would be not possible without the food industry or food factories. Iran has 82 million people, a number not easy to feed. The Iranian food industry is really vast, and it produces and exports nearly every type of halal food popular in the Middle East. If you, like me, had to waste 2 hours a day in the traffic, you wouldn't find 2 hours time for cooking a meal. So do forgive me for opting for ready meals. There are plenty of Iranian factories producing the ready meals that are so popular in today's world. But there are also those factories producing traditional Iranian food packaged to go with modern methods. Quality standards really matter with these products because such food may go unconsumed for days and weeks, in which time they must not lose quality or taste. On the other hand, they must not produce poisons harmful to the buyer. I've said plenty, but only to prepare you for a report by my dear friend Amir Mehdi Kazimi.
It is an inseparable part of every friendly gathering and birthday party in Iran, a cold hors d'oeuvre which many Iranians prefer as a main course. For decades, the old Russian potato salad, also known as Olivier salad in Iran, has gathered families and friends around one table. However, in the mid-90s, this tasty darling of the Iranians suddenly vanished from restaurants and sandwich shops across the country, after sales were banned by authorities due to hygiene concerns. But soon after, two close friends came up with a brilliant idea, and that was to get a legal license for the mass production of Olivier salad with all the health certificates.
Entrepreneurs say that ideas belong to those who execute them, and this is a good example of how combining the simplest materials along with proper planning could turn into a booming business, targeting a market with more than 80 million potential consumers.
Namino headquarters and main production facility is near Esfahan City. It is where the finest ingredients like potatoes, chicken, carrots, and mayonnaise are combined to prepare the most highly demanded Olivier salad in the entire country. The products are various, ranging from chicken and bologna salad to club sandwiches, rolls, and sausages. Nearly all machineries here are customized for the mass production of Russian potato salad and other cold meals. Observing the strictest health and food safety standards becomes even more difficult when it comes to mass producing foods which are made with fresh ingredients and served cold on the platter. And that seems to be the biggest challenge for the quality control department, whose task is to make sure that everything from flavor to hygiene goes perfectly well from point A to the end user. Iranians are a nation with a big appetite. Like other parts of the world, people have their preferences when it comes to food. Consumers could become very picky in a country with endless flavor choices. Namino produces all the ingredients used in the manufacturing process. The company even supervises the cultivation process of potatoes and carrots to make sure that they are exactly what is needed by the factory. Experts say that Iran is standing at a very good position when it comes to the quantity, the quality, and diversity of both agricultural and dairy products. And this has created a lucrative market for both investors and entrepreneurs. Today, Iranian consumers are faced with new packaging, new brands, new products, and higher standards every day. And those who once considered themselves as small business owners are now introducing themselves as food giants who are looking for markets outside the borders of the country. The two partners who once started from scratch now recruit a considerable number of people in their factories across the country. They also export food products to countries like the UAE, Oman, Qatar, Iraq, Afghanistan, Armenia, and Georgia, and there are hopes to create more demand in those markets. Today, Namino is a familiar name across Iran. The two friends who once joined hands and followed their dream to turn a tiny business into a big one created one of the most famous success stories among Iranian entrepreneurs. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Bazaar.
Thank you, Amir Mehdi, for the report on Namino.
Fats and oils have been around for a millennia. Historically, they have been seen as a source of dietary energy used to preserve foods or just for general cooking and baking. Vegetable oils are known for their numerous health benefits as they carry vital nutrients. They are essential for growth, metabolism, and protecting brain cells, among others. However, consuming too much edible oil brings about a whole host of health risks. Some oils have become available only recently as extraction technology has improved. The advancement of this industry has been contingent on science and research.
This week, we want to give center stage to vegetable oil production in the country. We wanted to see how this product is made in order to get a better understanding of how its market operates. We will also be checking out why edible oil is such a key ingredient in the national economy. Okay, enough said. Time to walk through today's greasy bazaar.
Our journey took us to the ancient city of Rey, near the capital Tehran. Here, we visited a company that was one of the first producers of vegetable oil in the country. Margarine was first established in 1954, but its edible oil production activity took place in 1954.